Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Jim Lehrer, who reads from and discusses his new novel, The Phony Marine, published by Random House. In the weeks to come, we have Nick Bantock, Alan Folsom, Chris Hedges, Kimberly Stewart, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to both welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. How this evening's guest finds the time to write the amazing novels that he does is a mystery, but somehow Jim Lehrer succeeds, and he has done it again with his new and 16th, yes, that's 16th novel, The Phony Marine, a fascinating and compelling novel about identities, deception, and what constitutes greatness. A true Marine, Jim served in the U.S. Marine Corps during the 1950s, and this past November he had the opportunity to speak about his time in the Marines at the dedication of the National Museum of the Marine Corps in Virginia, a transcript of which you can view on pbs.org. He did so with eloquence and dignity, attributes that he has brought to his long and distinguished journalism career. As most of you know, Jim anchors the nation's only hour-long nightly newscast with detailed analysis of major national and international issues on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He's also its executive director, editor. Many may have noticed how the theme orchestration has changed, something that didn't escape the attention of even his youngest fan, a boy in Minnesota who didn't pick Elmo for his third birthday party theme. He picked the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. The things you can find out on Google is amazing, just like his character in this book. Jim began his career in Dallas, first as a newspaperman covering the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963, and then later as the anchor on a local news show. He started work with PBS in 1972, and in 1975 started the McNeil-Lehrer Report with Robert McNeil, which of course has become the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Nicknamed the Dean of Moderators by CNN, Jim has been a moderator of 10 presidential debates, and he's been awarded the Presidential Humanities Award in 1999. And as we were just saying when I walked Mr. Lehrer up this evening, I just wanted to personally thank him for featuring our fallen soldiers each night on his news show. It is an honor to welcome Jim Lehrer back to the Tattered Cover. Please give a warm welcome to Jim Lehrer.
Delighted to be here. Always delighted to come to the Tattered Cover. I've been to this store a couple times, and the one at Cherry Creek. I don't have to tell you all that this is as good as it gets in the book business. I'm always nervous to come to any bookstore, though, for a book for an event like this. The first one I ever went to, for me, was for my first novel, Viva Max. I'm sure all of you have read it and memorized some of the key parts of it. The book was published in 1966, and it was about the retaking of the Alamo in modern-day times by a group of Mexican soldiers from Nuevo Laredo. They marched up and retook the Alamo. They made a movie out of it, in fact, with Peter Ustinov and Jonathan Winters, and you can still see it at 3 a.m. on some cable channels. But at any rate, when the book came out, there's a store, big department store, called Josky's, right next to the Alamo in downtown San Antonio. And they wanted to have a book party for me. And I was a newspaper man in Dallas. This was my mother and dad lived in San Antonio. I had gone to high school. This was a big deal for this book party. And I was going to sit for 2-3 hours in the book department of this biggest department store in San Antonio next to the Alamo. They took out an ad in the San Antonio newspapers every day leading up to it that Maximilian Rodriguez de Santos, that was the general make a long story short, they did a lot of publicity. They did all this stuff, and it was very exciting. My wife came with me. We had some friends who came from Dallas. Not one person came. I sat in the, and they had stacks of books, and a table like this, smaller table than this, and I sat right in the middle of the book section. And it was a Saturday, and nobody came. The only book I sold is that, because I'd gone to high school in San Antonio, some woman grown woman at that point, who I'd gone to high school with, just accidentally walked in to the book section and kind of looked over and said, "Is that you, Jim Wawa?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "What the hell are you doing sitting in the middle of the book tomorrow?" And I said, "Well," and I said, "That's what I'm doing here." Well, then she walked away. She talked a few minutes, and then she walked away. And then she felt guilty and came back, and she bought a copy of that. It was the only sale. I sat there for 3 hours. And so anyhow, I'm always a little nervous when I come to a book event, even at the Tattered Cover. Anyhow, thank you all for coming, and I appreciate it very much. The Phony Marine is my 16th novel. There's no question I would never have written this book, I'm sure, if I hadn't been a Marine myself. My dad was a Marine. My brother was a Marine. It's in my genes. And I'll tell you a little bit about the story, but I'm not going to tell you very much because I don't want to ruin it for you. But it's about, in some ways, it's about expectations. Somebody expects you to be a jerk, you act like a jerk. If somebody expects you to be a real good person, you act like a real good person. In this case, this is about a man who came to maturity during the Vietnam War. He was in college. He was eligible for the draft, but he wasn't drafted, and he chose not to go. And so now he's in his late 50s. He's selling men's clothes at a store in Washington. And through a set of circumstances that I won't bore you with, he buys a Silver Star medal set on eBay, which you can do, a real Silver Star that somebody had won in Vietnam. And the set includes the medal itself, a ribbon, and a little metal lapel pin that you wear in your coat. And so he started wearing the lapel pin, and people noticed that, oh, my goodness, you won the Silver Star. He made up his story about the fact that he had been an infantry platoon leader for the Marine Corps in Vietnam, and he had won the Silver Star, and he kind of recreated himself as a Marine. He got a haircut. He lost his paunch. He got himself in shape. He learned how to cuss really colorfully, do all the things that Marines do. But then he was stuck because it worked. But expectations are everything. And, for instance, in this room right now, something happened that caused us as a group to look around and say, we need a hero here, some event. And we looked around the room, and if there was some guy sitting there with a Silver Star lapel, we'd say, okay, it's you. You do something heroic because you are a hero. And that's what happens to my character. And how he deals with it and all that sort of stuff is what the book is about. And I'm really keen on expectations because I don't want to get too personal here, but it's just the fact of the matter is, in my own case, if my mother and father had not had high expectations for me, I don't think I would have turned out as well as I have. In other words, every time I was tempted to do something really bad, I would think, you know, Mom and Dad are not, they're expecting better things of me. And it was kind of a governor on my, like a governor on a car motor, they were kind of a governor on my behavior. So I've always been grateful to them for that. Of course, you know, the opposite is the case too. People rebel if they're expected to be certain ways and all that sort of thing. But in my case, that's the gist of the thing. And as I say, it was based on, a lot of the stuff came from my own Marine background. The mantra of writers, several of you I recognize are writers, you know, the mantra is, write about what you know about. I clearly did in this case. And of my other 15 novels, I told you about Viva Max. I was never in the Mexican Army, but I did live in San Antonio. I was always intrigued by the Alamo. So from the first book to this one, from the first to the 16th, I wrote a novel, and I think I came here for it. Patty, was it the B-29? Was it Special Prisoner that I came here? I don't remember. Anyhow, about some B-29 pilots who firebombed Tokyo during World War II. And my mother, during World War, we lived in Wichita, Kansas, And my mother worked on the B-29 assembly line. She was a wire cutter. And those kinds of, you know, these kinds of things stick. A book I wrote about the Battle of Antietam. I know I'm not a Civil War buff or any of that, but we just have, my wife and I have a house, a little farm that's 20 minutes from the Antietam battlefield. We go over there and exercise. And if you have to take my word for this, normally voices don't, I don't hear voices, but I began to hear voices. Have anybody here been to Antietam, the battlefield in Antietam? Well, you know, don't you? I mean, it is really a special place. I mean, it's almost like you can all, that, like you always, I always have the feeling when I'm there that the battle just ended a moment ago. It's because there's no build up. It's not on the way to anywhere, so it's not built up around, and the little town of Sharpsburg is the same. But anyhow, the voices started speaking to me, and I wondered, you know, they started, you know, I got interested in what happened in that, on that day. It was the bloodiest day in American history. And anyhow, to make it, that's how that book came about. And everything I know about the Civil War is in that book, by the way. People say, oh, they keep running when we talk about the Civil War. I say, I don't know anything about the Civil War. I just know about the Battle of Antietam and one small part of it. But it's a, my point is this. Yes, in most cases, I also wrote a couple of books about some former CIA, retired CIA agents who live up in the panhandle of West Virginia, where Kate's and my house is, and so the setting is all right. It's out of my thing, but I've never been in the CIA. But what's so great about writing about the CIA, you can write anything. You can just make it up. I'll tell you a quick story about that. You writers will appreciate this. First one was called Blue Hearts, and it the deal had been that and like a Purple Heart given for the military, and at the CIA, if you're injured or wounded in the line of duty, they give you a certificate and a medal, and in the agency they call them Purple Dots. Blue Hearts. Well, the second book, of the same guys, is called Purple Dots, and it's based on the idea that, you know, when you're an FBI agent or a CIA agent has somebody under surveillance or doing something in Washington. And suddenly the person jumps out of a car or something, it's very difficult for these agents to find a place to park. And they'd park at a fire hydrant, and the cops would come along and tow the car and all that. So anyhow, several years ago, they invented this system, a little purple dot that could not be replicated by anybody, and it would put down the left-hand corner of a license plate, and every police agency in the Washington area knows if you come across an illegally parked car and there's a purple dot on it, leave it alone. Well, now, I made all this up. I made up the blue hearts, and I made up the purple dots. The reviewer of Blue Hearts, a guy I'd never met, gave it a nice review, but he wrote about Blue Hearts as if it was a real thing. I read his credentials, and the credentials showed, you know, that this was a man who knew the CIA upside and one side and the other. Purple dots. I was at a party. A man came up to me who, if I told you his name, you would recognize it. Because what happened in my book, at least, because I made it up, but that it was designed for FBI agents and CIA agents, but other people in government, hey, think about that. Sometimes it's very hard to park in Washington, if you could park anywhere. So it became kind of a badge of status, you know, to have a purple dot on your license plate. Anyhow, this guy came up to me and he said, Jim, I read your book. They didn't give me a purple. This guy was a really big shot in the U.S. He said, they never gave me a purple dot when I was in the government. And I said, I looked at this guy, and I was that close to just saying, oh, gosh, you must not have been very important or whatever. Or something. But I copped out. I told him the thing. Anyhow. The interesting thing about, you know, it doesn't apply so much to the CIA, but it does in a way, and it certainly applies to the Civil War and applies to the B-29s and the flying over Tokyo during World War II and all of that, is that because of the nature of my job, I still see myself as a reporter and always will be a reporter. But the nature of my job now, which is basically to interview people in the studio and all of that, I don't go out on stories anymore. So I get my reporting kicks out of writing these novels and doing the research. I do all the research myself. I love it. I just love doing it, and particularly when it's something, what happened at the Battle of Antietam? Well, I read everything that had been written. I went into archives and all that sort of stuff. Same thing when I got into the B-29 pilot. These were kids who were flying those planes. They were 17, 18, 19-year-old kids flying these. Most of them didn't even have driver's licenses when they went into the U.S. Army Air Corps, and they were flying these big planes, 20,000 with all kinds of armament and all that sort of stuff. Anyhow, my point is that writing fiction is writing fiction, but getting ready to write it is a great process for me as well as the writing itself. Now, I know most of you, not all of you, because some of you I know personally out here, but most of you probably think of me as the TV guy who also writes novels, and probably some of you may not have even known I wrote novels, you know, until recently. But you're not alone if that's your case. But just for the record, I want everybody to understand that I've been writing novels just as long as I have been doing journalism. I just thought of it a moment ago, the Writer's Park, is it called, a couple of blocks away? Writer's Square. But I'm from the Hemingway generation of newspaper people. Hemingway said, if you want to write, you want to write fiction, get a job on a newspaper. It'll force you to deal with it'll force you to deal with the English language in some semi-coherent way on a regular basis, and it will expose you to all kinds of people who can later become characters and happenings that can later become events in your fiction. And most importantly, it'll keep bread on the table while you're writing. Well, I took all of that. When I was 16, 17 years old, I decided I wanted to be a writer. And so the journalism was part of that decision. And I actually thought I would be a sports writer and cover baseball and all that sort of stuff. I never did end up doing that. But since then, I was in Beaumont, Texas, down on the Texas Gulf Coast at that time, sophomore in high school. And for all practice, except for the 3 years I was in the Marine Corps, I've been doing that. I've been writing fiction. Even when I was in the Marine Corps, I wrote short stories. I've written something like 47 short stories, none of which have ever been published, and none of which deserves to be published. But I've been writing these two. I've been doing these things side by side, not at the same time. You know, not in the same thing. But I've been writing both. And someday, you know, who knows? Maybe I'll be known as the novelist who also does television journalism on the side. I would hope so. Let me take your questions, comments. I know people come to these events with questions. Just remember two things: guidelines for your questions. This is a literary event, and it wouldn't help you anyhow because I'm not a pundit, so I'm not going to tell you what I think about the Baker-Hamilton study group report and the reaction. Even if this were not a literary event, I wouldn't tell you that. And the other thing you need to keep in mind is I do not handle criticism well. So, but other than that, any questions, comments? Well, let me tell you about that. Because I am asked about it a lot, and it does mystify people. But it's actually very simple. All you have to do is go and have a heart attack. And that's what I did. And that really got my attention. And it was in 1983 I had a heart attack. And then about to have another one. I had a bypass a few weeks later. The doctor said to me, I don't know how, you know, we don't know what the end result of this is all going to be, you know, as I was recovering. And he said, you know, if I were you, Jim, I would try to kind of reduce the level of activity and stress in your life. And I said, what is your suggestion for how to do that, sir? Because at that time, we had three children. I have a daily news job, and I was, and I had a lot of other things. And so he said, here's what you do. Make a list of all the things you do in your life that cause stress, take time, whatever, and then go back through and eliminate half of them. And I did. And the criteria I used, which was his criteria, leave the things on the list that you really want to do and go through a process. It says, okay, for instance, I'm standing here. I didn't have to come to Denver. I didn't have to come to the Tattered Cover tonight. There were a lot of other things I could have done, you know, with my time, you know. I made a concrete decision, and I go through this for everything that I do. And sometimes, you know, there are things in my life that I have to do, but fewer and fewer. I'm fortunate. I'm really fortunate because a lot of people don't have that luxury. There's just certain things you've got to do and whatever. Anyhow, I made the list. And because of the nature of the job and because our girls were growing up and all of that, my writing had to put it aside. I had to put it aside. And so I put it back on the list. And I realized if I had 5 days, 5 years, 50 years left, I was going to spend a big hunk of that time getting back and writing my fiction. So an interesting thing happened. Once I eliminated all the things I didn't want to do, I found I had plenty of time to do the things I wanted. That's what I had. Then I had to organize my time. And it's in simple terms, it's like this. I get up very early in the morning. I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I exercise for an hour. And then I go to the office. I'm at the office, it's Eastern time now, at 8:30 every day. Not every day, but most days, okay? And we work morning newspaper hours, meaning our editorial process starts at 10 o'clock. Essentially, there's nobody there in our office for the first 2 hours that I'm there. And that's when I write. And I do it every day. Every day I do something on my novels. It could be, I don't mean I write a new wonderful sentence or paragraph. It may be some research, maybe some editing or something. But I move the thing up the chalkboard. And so things never get cold on me. I don't have to say, oh, my God, what is this book I'm working on all about and all that sort of stuff. It's like having a low-grade fever. It's with me all the time. And that's how I'm able to do it. I write on airplanes. I write on weekends. Fortunately, my wife, many of you know, Kate Lara, is a novelist. So we speak the same emotional language, meaning one of us gets into a funk about a character or a storyline that isn't working and doesn't speak, you know, for a day, the other one understands and gets it. And that's a lot of people don't get it. I mean, you're married to a writer who doesn't talk for 3 days because he or she can't get the character right. That can cause strife in a relationship. And Kate and I don't have that problem. So that's how I'm able to do it. And I'm very fortunate to be able to do this. And the 16th came out. This the one where that's the phony. The 17th is not only done, it's now being set in type. It's going to come out in October of 2007. It's done. And I am now working on the 18th. And and my editor, this wonderful man, says, you know, Jim, at least you could take as much time as it takes to make a baby to make a book. You know, we're down. Now, this will come out. There will only be 11 months between from the time this book comes out until the next one comes out. And they're crowding it a little bit. It probably works. It's probably a disadvantage in some ways, but I can't help it. And I'm not going to worry about it. You know, each book, you know, is not a special event. When a new book of mine comes out, people don't stop in the streets and say, oh my God, finally, here's another Lara book. And they say, oh my God, here's another Lara book. So anyhow, I don't have any choice. It's so much pleasure. It gives me so much pleasure. Anyhow, long answer. Robert McNeil, my friend and former partner, used to say, Lara, if you're ever a guest on our program, we never have you back because your answers are so damn long. But yes. Well, you know, most people, and I'm no different, it's the latest book is your favorite, or the one you're working on is the favorite. But I'll tell you, the second favorite is for me is a book called White Widow, which came out about the 12th book, I guess, or I don't remember. But it's about a bus driver. I worked when I went to a little junior college in South Texas, first 2 years of college, and at night I worked in a bus depot as a ticket agent, and call the buses and all. And I'll give you a bus call if you'd like for me to in a moment. But at any rate, one of the and so I was around bus drivers all the time, and bus driver lingo, some of which is repeatable, some of which is not. Like marine lingo. I don't know why I hadn't thought of that till this moment. But anyhow, maybe that's why. Never mind what that means. At any rate, a white widow is, in bus driver lingo, is an attractive woman traveling alone. And so this bus driver, my character, who drives a Continental Trailways bus, I call it something else, but between Houston and Corpus Christi, where I worked in the bus depot was in Victoria, Texas, which is halfway between Houston and Corpus Christi. Anyhow, this bus driver has an affair with a white widow. but only in his mind. Only in a real person, a real white widow is on his bus. He has an affair with her only in his imagination, but with real world consequences. But it is a book that it's my second favorite out of behind the one I'm just working on or whatever, because it's very personal in a way. Not personal about me. I did not have an affair with a white widow. The bus was bus driver. I was a ticket agent. And I was also 18 years old. Yes, sir. No, and I made a dumb mistake last weekend. We were with one of our daughters who's married and has three kids, lives outside New York, and we were up there. And on the way up, I said to my wife, you know something, Amanda's our youngest daughter's name. I said, you know, Amanda would have made, because the Marine thing, because of the Quantico speech and all that sort of stuff, very fresh in our minds and all that. And I said, you know, it's too bad Amanda didn't go into Marine Corps. She would have made one hell of a Marine. And she said, are you crazy? When you have daughters, you don't think of them going into the Marines and all that sort of stuff. So then she tells Amanda this. And in front of her kids, you know, two little boys and a little girl. Little girl's too small. She didn't get it. But, I mean, it was just really, really peculiar. And then I started to say, well, no, I didn't really mean you should have gone into the Marines, you know, and all this. Because the problem with all this now, I mean, let's face it, is Iraq. And, you know, the other two daughters would never, and of course Amanda then says in front of her kids, you know, I thought about that myself, Dad, and I would have been a good Marine. I have no regrets about not having done it, but you're right. I probably should have done it, the experience. You know, and then I'm really in trouble, see, because anyhow. But the answer to your question is no. Yes, sir. And I'll tell you an interesting story. Here again, I'm proving McNeil's point again, but it's related to the current book, The Phony Marine. The guy who helped me with the Antietam book is an archaeologist for the National Park Service, and I just called him Colt. I knew he was an archaeologist, you know, and he really helped me. I mean, this guy was terrific, and I'd read a story about him in the paper, in the Washington Post, about he was trying to identify three remains of three Irishmen who had been killed and different part of the battlefield. So anyhow, that's how I got his name. Called him Cold. He helped me. He had been in Vietnam in the Army. And he asked me, after No Certain Rest came out, he asked me to speak to a group from the National Park Service, 200-300 people getting together for some kind of meeting or something, lunch or something, and I said, sure. And he came out and picked me up, because where the speech was, National Park Place, was only about 5-6 minutes from my office. So he just dropped by and picked me up. And on the way over, he said, you know, Jim, I hadn't realized until I was looking at your official bio that your office sent me that you had been an infantry officer in the Marine Corps. And he said, what? I said, well, the Korean War was on, you know, the draft was on, you had your choice. The only choice you had is what branch you went, or you'd be drafted and all that sort of stuff. And I was kind of telling him the story when we got there. And so then we immediately got out of the car, and we run a little late. And then we get up, like, you know, in a room like this, you know, going around lunch tables. And he introduces me, and he says the following. I'm paraphrasing, but it's almost word for word. He said, you all know about this guy, Lee here, her, and he's this and he's this, but probably one thing you do not know is that he was an infantry platoon commander for the United States Marine Corps in combat in the Korean War. Now, and these people looked at me with an appreciation and whatever, and I loved the look, you see. In other words, I loved them thinking of me as some kind of, you know, in some kind of heroic way, all right? And I didn't want to correct him. I mean, I loved it so much. See, I mean, I had 50% of it going for me. I mean, I was an infantry officer in the Marine Corps. The Korean War was on when I signed up, but it was over by the time I actually went on active duty. So I was in between the Korean War and no fire, a round was ever fired in anger at me, and I never fired into anybody else. I was never in combat. But I loved this whole thing. And when I got up, the whole thing about not wanting to correct the record and let these people think I had been in combat. It stuck with me. And so that was also something that fed the writing of the Phony Marine, you know, several years later, because I knew. And then we had the Joe Ellis case. We had a lot of other things, you know, where people enhanced and somebody, I just got a letter from somebody, a guy who had been in the military in the Korean War, during the Korean War, and never went overseas. But it's one of those things within his own family. He didn't ever really lied. He just remained silent. And everybody in his family thought he had been in combat in the Korean War. And he never left the States. It's kind of like the Joe Ellis thing in a way. And as he read my novel, and made him feel badly, and he wrote me and he said, "Mr. Lehrer, I just wanted you to know I don't remember how many kids he had, now grown." He said, "I've taken each one of them aside and told them that their dad let them grow up thinking something about him that was not true." And I thought, well, that's great, but maybe it isn't. I don't know. Apparently the kids took it all very well. Anyhow, in other words, it's kind of in the water sometimes, and as we know. Yes, sir. Thank you. Amazing. Thank you. All right, well. You just violated the rule, but that's okay. I'll let it go. Speaking of the NewsHour, there are some folks here from the NewsHour here tonight. Stand up, please. Patty, Dan Segallen. Yeah. Patty, we have an office out here. Patty runs it. She's a managing producer out here. Most of our tape and all that stuff is done out of Denver. Patty, how long have you been with us now? Since 83. Yeah, since we went to an hour. Yeah, right. Dan Segallen is on our foreign affairs staff out of Washington. He's here he was here for health reasons at the first of all, you're at the Jewish you were at the Jewish hospital second. At the
University of Colorado.
Yeah. But see how well he's doing?
Yeah.
But he covers security issues on our foreign affairs staff, the Pentagon, intelligence, and all of that, and he's the best there is. Okay, yes, sir. Did you all hear the question? It was about what my 19th novel was going to be. What, you wanted to know what my 19th novel was going to be? Oh, that's, I have peaks and valleys about it like anybody else, but the one thing about journalists, particularly somebody who's been doing it as long as I have, you have to be very optimistic. Journalism is a profession for optimists, because you have to believe that problem can be solved. You have to believe that people are going to get their act together and resolve Iraq. You have to believe they're going to get their act together and reform Social Security, whatever it is, because if you didn't believe that, you couldn't do it. You couldn't ask, another set of these people or that or whatever. It's interesting, because it's just the opposite of that. All the journalists are all cynics or whatever. They're just the opposite. I mean, you've got to be upbeat. You've got to be excited about ideas. You've got to be excited about meeting new and different. You've got to be excited about a good sentence. You got all those things. It's all little boy, little girl work. And so I am basically always optimistic. I really do believe that things will always get better. They may get worse first. But and I think, for instance, you look back, just to be specific, and even though you violated the rule, now I'm violating my own rule. But the bottom line, for instance, I think the midterm elections was a huge, hugely positive thing. Not anything to do about Democrats and Republicans. It's that the 80% of the American people in the middle, not the left wing 10% or the right wing 10%, rose up and said, right wing, left wing, forget it. We want these things solved now. And that's a very positive thing. And it eventually happens. So our system, it's a weird system. Let's face it. Sometimes it works better than that, but it is self-corrective. All of the things that go wrong, there are things in the system that eventually correct those things, because the system itself is flexible and it works. Now, there are times, ups and downs and whatever. So, no, I'm not down at all about America right now. I think that we, in fact, I'm very. very optimistic, but I tell you, I'm always optimistic. And one last question. Yes.
You have stepped so far over the line that I'm going to act like you didn't even ask that second question, and I'll answer your first because it's almost on subject. The answer is no. I mean, I've written about journalism in a book called The Last Debate. I wrote a memoir that had some early stuff about the NewsHour in it, about journalism. I know I get my kicks in writing the fiction. I'm not saying I wouldn't ever do it. I thought about writing, I was asked to write a book about moderating, called Moderator, a nonfiction thing about my presidential debate thing, but also just generally, a kind of a handbook, all that sort of stuff. And I said yes, and then I said no. What energizes me on the writing is the writing of the fiction. What energizes me in the journalism is I'm a daily journalist. And I get up every day, and it's a new day for me. And it's a new day. Today is just as new as it was when I started 40 years ago. So anyhow. Look, again, thank you all for coming. Appreciate it very much. And I thank, except for the couple of you, for... I appreciate your following the rules. Okay, thank you. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Nick Bantock, Alan Folsom, Chris Hedges, Kimberly Stewart, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on December 8th, 2006.